Mental health matters. It's not just a hashtag. Our mental health directly informs our everyday thoughts, feelings, behaviors, and ultimately our physical health. Our medical outcomes are directly informed by mental health. We need to address it just like we do any other part of our health.
That's Lucy McBride, practicing internist in Washington, D.C., who's become known and appreciated for straight talk on surviving the pandemic. A graduate of Princeton University and Harvard Medical School, Dr. McBride completed her internship and residency at Johns Hopkins. With a focus on treating the whole person, her guiding principle has always been that mental health not only matters in medicine, it actually defines our health and humanity. I'm Lou Anne Heinen, and this is the Business Group on Health podcast, conversations with experts on the most important health and well-being issues facing employers today. My guest is Dr. Lucy McBride, and we're going to talk about pandemic anxiety, fear of normal, and how we struggle to assess risk when the threat is constantly changing. Welcome, Lucy. I'm excited for our conversation today. I have so many questions I've been building up to ask you.
I am thrilled to be here.
I'm going to start with, on your website, you share a bit about your outlook when it comes to patient care. And one phrase really jumped out at me. What did you mean by, quote, mental health defines our health and humanity?
Thank you for asking that important question. Mental health is an essential part of our whole health. I think about patients as the integrated sum of different components. In other words, we're not just a set of boxes to check. We have emotional lives, we have thoughts, we have feelings, we have behaviors that come from those thoughts and feelings. And those things directly inform our physical health and our medical outcomes. So it's important that we think about mental health not as a luxury or a sidebar issue, but rather part of our whole health.
One of the phrases you've coined is something called FONO, fear of normal. How does that relate to our mental health?
The pandemic is really a parallel pandemic of mental health and crisis alongside this potentially lethal virus, coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2. When we are faced with a threat like a potentially lethal virus, we are naturally going to be anxious. We are going to be in a state of hypervigilance, alertness, and fear and anxiety are normal in that context. We have been, as you know, in a state of vulnerability, anxiety, uncertainty, and fear for over a year. So it's normal to be facing some anxiety as we try to pivot from a fear-based way of thinking to resuming parts of our lives that we've been missing.
We all want that so badly. And yet, I sense a but.
We all want to be back to normal. We want to be back at school, at work, at church, at the synagogue. We want to be socializing. Not only do we want to, we need to. I mean, the emotional health fallout from lives upended, routines thrown out the window, the loss, the death, the destruction, the economic, social, emotional despair that we've experienced is enormous. So we want to be back to normal. The challenge is that people have been in a fear mode naturally for the last 12, 14 months. So it's going to be hard. We can expect ourselves to have emotional reactions to the pivot back to normalcy. That would be expected. If you're human, you're going to have some ambivalence and anxiety about testing the waters.
So FONO, or fear of normal, you're saying is a normal reaction to the kind of anxiety we've experienced. And now the fact that in some ways the threat level is changing and we don't know exactly what that means for us. Is that the challenge?
That's right. The challenge is that we're facing uncertainty that now involves doing things that we've been conditioned not to do for the last year. So when we have to make decisions every day, from putting our child back in school or showing up at work or socializing with other people that are potentially harmful to us and we have been worried about a virus like coronavirus for over a year, it's only normal to have fear. So what I'm recommending to my patients one at a time, and what I'm recommending now to my wider audience through my newsletter and other publications, is to think about how your anxiety affects you physically and mentally, and to then fact check your anxiety. Because if you can fact check your anxiety and realize that perhaps your anxiety about going back to work or school is out of proportion to the facts, then you can start to make progress. So, for example, many of my vaccinated patients are afraid of seeing loved ones, of socializing, when the fact of the matter is that when you've been vaccinated, your chance of getting COVID-19 is extremely small. The real world data is clear that it's very, very hard actually to get COVID-19 after vaccination. So one of the ways we mitigate FOMO, or the fear of normalcy, is by telling people exactly what they're getting with vaccination. And it's really a ticket to the future.
Do you foresee a situation where, you know, you've mentioned in your HuffPost article that anxiety itself is making us sick. Do you see that continuing as we move into reentry, approach normalcy? Are you worried about an ongoing epidemic of anxiety?
Absolutely. I mean, it's normal to be anxious in a global pandemic when our lives have been upended and our routines tossed out the window. It's also normal to have physical reactions to that anxiety. For example, my patients are having soaring blood pressure readings. Their diabetes is under worse control. You know, not everyone is having physical manifestations of stress, but a lot of people are. We can also expect there to be ripple effects after the normalcy has started to gradually begin. We know from traumas, collective traumas, like, for example, 9/11, that for years after the event, there is an uptick in, for example, cardiovascular disease that is not unrelated to the emotional reaction to stress. So now that we've all experienced some sort of emotional distress in a pandemic, we can expect in real time to feel anxious. We can also expect there to be reverberations in our physical and emotional health.
Yeah. Yeah.
The hopeful side of this message is that there are things you can do now and in the future to mitigate your fear.
And what about kids? I know you're a mom of teenagers and you also see adolescents as patients. Are they experiencing the same thing? Are there any differences?
That's a great question. Kids are uniquely traumatized by the pandemic. Yes, I'm a mother of three teenagers. Kids need school like fish need water. It's not only for reading, writing, and arithmetic, it's for their social and emotional health, to be with their peers, to be with faculty, staff, administrators. And as you know, for many kids, it's a safe place. It's where they get fed, is at school. So for every reason, kids need to be in school. And for every reason, when kids are not in school, they are in distress. Obviously, there's a range of suffering among different kids. Some kids, for example, are doing maybe better in the pandemic. If they had, you know, high school anxiety or middle school social anxiety, you know, maybe that eased off. But for most children, it has been a very distressing time, and that is reflected in their mental health and in their physical health.
You know, we're all in agreement, virtually all in agreement, about kids going back to school. But I think that there's a lot of concern, disagreement, and pending upheaval around adults going back to work. I mean, given the need, as you've pointed out, to name, normalize, and navigate fears about reentry, what are you hearing from your patients? What's on their minds when it comes to return to work?
People are very afraid of going back to work, naturally, because for a long time, we've been told work is not safe. Indoor spaces are not safe. But it's important to note that once you have been vaccinated, and hopefully most Americans who want the vaccine will be vaccinated soon, you are protected from getting COVID-19 and the severe consequences from it. So what I'm recommending to my patients who are anxious about going back to work after vaccination is to let's go through the data. Let's go through the scientific evidence about vaccination. The New England Journal of Medicine published real-world data in mid-March showing that the risk of getting COVID-19 is 0.05% after vaccination.
I was just going to ask, does that mean if you're vaccinated and you have no idea if your coworkers are or aren't, that you shouldn't worry?
Whether or not you should worry is up to the person, but it means that you are entitled to feeling very, very comfortable having been vaccinated, that your risk of death and severe disease is essentially off the table, that your risk of getting symptomatic COVID is very, very low. And if you happen to be in the small percentage of people, in the unlikely category of people who does get COVID after vaccination, you would likely have a cold or a mild flu. So when I'm able to put the fine point, the evidence-based information in front of my patient, then they can start to relax and understand that going back to work is not the threat that it was.
So most employers we've spoken with aren't at this point interested in any kind of vaccine, you know, passport or certification for coming back to work, at least for office work. We're not talking healthcare. And I think what you're saying then is other office workers, colleagues who don't have any assurance from the employer about who's vaccinated can feel confident going back to work.
What I'm saying is that if you've been vaccinated, your risk of getting COVID-19 is extremely low. It's not impossible, because like anything in life, nothing is 100%, but it's pretty darn close.
And we all take the risk of a cold or getting a flu.
Exactly. So the risk of getting COVID-19 after vaccination is tiny and actually smaller than the risk that you and I took every day without thinking about it before the pandemic about getting a cold. In fact, you know, some of us would even go to work or fly on a plane with a cold or a sniffle. So it's important to frame the data and the science for people, because one of the challenges for people in the pandemic and one of the drivers of their anxiety has been the deluge of information coming at them, like water out of a fire hydrant. So when I'm able to take the information and distill it down and deliver it to a patient who's been vaccinated and explain exactly how safe they are after vaccination, that mitigates anxiety.
So given that, what guidance would you have for employers when it comes to managing the return to workplace process for employees, especially knowing that there are latent fears and concerns that may not be shared openly with managers and HR?
I love that question, because it's so important to realize as employers that our employees bring their whole selves to the office. They bring the fact that they are parenting kids on Zoom school, that they may be caring for elder family members, that they have experienced stress and distress during the pandemic. And they bring those things to the workplace. So the first thing I recommend to employers, and frankly to myself as an employer and as a doctor with staff, is to understand that people bring their whole selves to work and to create a space so that people feel seen, they feel understood, that they are human too. There is a person behind the Zoom screen, behind the delivery truck, behind the checkout counter. And we need to understand that we've all been through this together. The second advice I have for employers is to make sure that you are employing as many of the risk mitigation elements as you feasibly can. We know well how to mitigate risk: masking, distancing, and ventilation. So if you can enforce those risk mitigation elements at the workplace, you are protecting people's safety and their sanity.
There are people in offices who say, what's the point of going back to work for collaboration, for social connection, you know, to swash the loneliness and, you know, reconnect our, you know, with our friends at work if we're going to be socially distant and wearing masks?
Well, It's a great question. There are certain jobs that really can't be done remotely, of course. The essential workers, God love them, have been working the whole time.
Yes.
But if it's possible to work remotely when, for example, case rates in your district are high, that is ideal. At the same time, if we look ahead right now to the UK and Israel, and we look at their curves, the real world data on what's happening, we can expect in the United States to be in a much better place, even as soon as the summer, compared to where we are now, which is a ton better than we were even a couple of weeks ago. The point being that we are going to be able to go back to work in person. We will not need to have masks and distancing forever. We will win the race against the virus by mass vaccination. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah. So the masks and the distancing are really to protect those who haven't been vaccinated, who may show up at work.
That's exactly right. So when you've been vaccinated, you are protected from getting COVID-19 almost fully. You're also protected from transmitting the virus to others. Again, it's not 100%, but your risk of transmitting the virus to other people or sickening other people is also reduced after vaccination. It's unvaccinated people who are at risk of getting sick themselves and transmitting the virus. But as we get closer to herd immunity, as more people in this country are getting vaccinated, the risk goes down even for unvaccinated people. So public health, as you know, is a moving, evolving picture, just like our own individual health profiles and emotional and physical health. It's all on a continuum, it's all on a spectrum, and it's also moving and changing in real time. So the short story is, even in a couple of months, once those who want the vaccine have been offered the vaccine, we are going to slowly be able to unmask, not worry about distancing, and really get back to normal. If you had asked me a couple of months ago, did I think that we would be in this position? I would have said, I don't think so. But it's very clear at this moment in April where we're heading, which is in a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful direction, but with a lot of work to do for cleaning up.
Yeah, it's really exciting. We've talked about mental health challenges and experience, but let's briefly explore the other, quote, corners of healthcare that you base your patient interactions on. Can you describe those other three corners?
Sure. So I think of patients as the integrated sum of different components. Medical data is essential, but it has to be put in context. For example, your cholesterol. Your cholesterol relates to one of the other corners, which is your nutrition. Not only what you eat, but how you eat, your relationship to food. That's one corner, nutrition, and any inputs into your system. The other corner is mechanics of your body. We all know that exercise is good for just about everything, from managing diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, preventing dementia, for anxiety and depression. Exercise is good for just about everything. Addressing our body mechanics to be then able to exercise is part of my job, to help people with muscle tone, fitness, pain control, spine alignment, and all of the myriad pieces of our skeletons. Those need to be put in context as well. And then the last corner is mental health. Not least important, but mental health does play an enormous role in our whole health.
What I love is that as a primary care physician, you're willing to take on not just the, you know, the biometric data,
right,
and nutrition and body mechanics and mental health, all of that. Some primary care physicians would address none but the medical data.
Well, that's the thing. So patients are walking around with Fitbits, heart monitors, sleep monitors. They have so much data, but not enough care. So the job and the role of the primary care doctor is to take that data and put it in context. When I can address someone's data, nutritional inputs, body mechanics, and mental health in concert, we're doing the best job we can to get that person healthy, mentally and physically.
And good nutrition does feel like a challenge during the pandemic. What advice do you have for people who are trying to eat more healthfully? or get back to where they were post-pandemic.
So yeah, so nutrition is necessary but not sufficient for good health, right? There are people who eat really poorly and live till they're 105, and then there are people who eat quote unquote perfectly and develop diseases they can't control. But let's agree that it's an essential part of health to eat nutritious foods. It's also essential to identify and troubleshoot any relationship with food issues you might have. So a lot of my patients, and I would consider myself in the same category, sometimes stress eat. Or in the pandemic, we know that alcohol has gone way up. The increase in alcohol is largely because people are looking for a way to turn off the anxiety spigot, put some sort of corner around, you know, daytime to segue into nighttime. But as a result of stress eating and more alcohol use, people are having higher blood pressures, weight is going up.
Yeah.
So when I'm talking to a patient about their weight gain, for example, or their blood pressure, I don't say tisk, tisk, tisk. How could you have gained weight? That's not good for you. We talk about what are the drivers here? What are the issues that are going on in your day-to-day life that we can then troubleshoot to help you with your relationship to food and then steer those feelings in another direction that are potentially more healthful?
You know, we haven't talked about sleep, which relates to mental health and some of these other corners that you're talking about. Are you finding that your patients are having trouble sleeping due to anxiety and other concerns about the virus?
100%. So you could call it, if you wanted to, coronasomnia. People either don't have time to sleep because they're parenting and they're caring for elderly parents and they're afraid themselves for various reasons and therefore restless at night. So I definitely see an increase in anxiety-related sleeplessness. Sleep is the glue for our mental health. Sleep is essential for our mood, stress management, cognition, attention, focus. So one of the things I've commonly discussed with my patients in the office is how to troubleshoot their lack of adequate sleep. And that includes things like turning off your phone, getting away from screens for at least an hour before bedtime, which is often very difficult, minimizing stimulants. So as much as we all love coffee, minimizing caffeine intake, particularly afternoon, and then trying a meditation app or some bedtime routine to wind down and quiet the noisy brain that often keeps us up at night.
So let me share that a couple of months ago, I myself had COVID-19, as did my husband. And we were on the phone with his primary care physician having a virtual visit. And that doctor suggested out of the blue, we'd said nothing about sleep, that you guys should get some melatonin gummies and take those. You know, each of you take two a night to sleep. And since then, I've heard of more people using that as well as CBD gummies. Those weren't on your list.
That's because the list is long and it really depends on the person in front of me.
Okay.
So there's no one-size-fits-all prescription, yeah, right, for insomnia. I mean, for some people, sleeplessness is because of menopause, hot flashes, night sweats. For some people, it's because of anxiety. For some people, it's because they have sleep apnea. So, but certainly melatonin and CBD oil are things that I recommend depending on the person. Yeah, So it's really not a one-size-fits-all prescription, but rather something we, you know, apply nuanced guidance to.
And not just when someone is in the throes of COVID, but more routinely, potentially?
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard enough to get sleep in the pandemic, but it's also hard to get sleep in general. We're overstimulated, many of us, by screen time and internet connectivity. So it's something I talk about with people all the time, even before the pandemic, that prioritizing sleep, creating a bedtime, working on sleep hygiene, that is important for your whole health.
You know, one of the things that I read in your article, may have been the Washington Post article, was that you're noticing that there's currently a bumper crop of people who don't trust. And I'm wondering, that's just not something that physicians are seeing in practice. It's something, I mean, that we're seeing everywhere in our society. Just wondering if you have any insights on that. What to do about people who don't trust, whether it's trust in the vaccine or trust in physician recommendations. Any observations?
Absolutely. I mean, trust is the currency in medicine. For me to help a patient, they have to feel that they are in a safe, non-judgmental space where my only agenda is helping them and helping them help themselves. We live in a world, as you well know, where we have so many megaphones, so many experts, and so many people who, you know, encapsulate their point of view in a tweet, that it can be very confusing for people when they're looking for advice and nuanced guidance. And then particularly in a pandemic where information is coming at us 100 miles an hour, the information we need is not always easy to find. We need doctors, in my opinion, and trusted guides more than ever to help us make everyday decisions, whether it's, can I go to the hair salon after my vaccine, to what medicine should I take for my sleep? And this is arguably the role of a primary care doctor, is to help marry public health advice with your unique health condition and to provide nuanced guidance to manage mental and physical health in tandem. That can't be found on Twitter.
Beautifully said.
Thank you. I was absolutely happy about that.
Really great. Really great. Yeah. And I think that we're not very good, most of us individually, at assessing risk. And we make decisions that are, yeah, emotional or based on the last thing we heard. So really, there's no substitute for that trusted partner.
I think that's right. There are many, many reasons why we're in a trust desert in this country. There's natural distrust of the government, of pharma, of really anyone. But the role of science and medicine is really to find the truth and then to deliver it to patients and, of course, to the general public if you're in public health, because ultimately science has our back. And so one of the ways that I'm helping people mitigate anxiety and move forward with their lives is by helping them trust again, whether it's me or some other expert, and find the truth amidst the noise. It's hard. It requires some level of vulnerability on the person who wants to be guided, but you can't go wrong with science.
Well, I am so glad you found science in medicine, or it found you, because the way that you're able to serve your own patients and the broader community through your newsletter and through your communications is truly a gift. And it's been my pleasure to interview you today and share some of that with our audience.
I'm really, really honored to be here. And if I can help one other patient distill complex information and then apply it to their own life in some way, that makes me happy.
I've been speaking with Dr. Lucy McBride about her fact-based medical guidance on getting through the pandemic physically and mentally. For more information, go to lucymcbride.com, where you can subscribe to Dr. McBride's legendary newsletter. This podcast is produced by Business Group on Health with Connected Social Media. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please give us a rating. Your reviews help others discover the podcast. I'm Luann Heinen. Thanks for listening.